already passed, and the many deaths they have already suffered, and who are unhappy because they think that one day their world will end. But have even more pity for those who already know their many deaths, and today think of themselves as immortal. Neither of these kinds of people know thy law that says, except that one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God. Have pity on those who bind themselves with the silken ties of love, and think of themselves as masters of others, and who feel envy and poison themselves, and who torture themselves because they cannot see that love and all things change like the wind. But pity even more those who die of their fear of loving, and who reject love in the name of a greater love that they know not. Neither of these kinds of people know thy law that says, whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. Pity those who reduce the cosmos to an explanation, God to a magic potion, and humanity to beings with basic needs that must be satisfied, because they never hear the music of the spheres. But have even more pity on those who have blind faith, and who in their laboratories transform mercury into gold, and who are surrounded by their books about the secrets of the tarot and the power of the pyramids. Neither of these kinds of people know thy law that says, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will by no means enter it. Pity those who see no one but themselves, and for whom others are a blurred and distant scenario as they pass through the streets in their limousines and lock themselves in their air-conditioned penthouse offices, as they suffer in silence the solitude of power. But pity even more those who will do anything for anybody, and are charitable, and seek to win out over evil only through love. For neither of these kinds of people know thy law that says, let he who has no sword sell his garment and buy one. Have pity, Lord, on we who seek out and dare to take up the sword that you have promised, and who are a saintly and sinful lot scattered throughout the world. Because we do not recognize even ourselves, and often think that we are dressed, but we are nude. We believe that we have committed a crime, when in reality we have saved someone's life. And do not forget in your pity for all of us that we hold the sword with the hand of an angel and the hand of a devil, and that they are both the same hand, because we are of the world, and we continue to be of the world. And we have need of thee. We will always be in need of thy law that says, when I sent you without money bag, knapsack, and sandals, you lacked nothing. Petrus ended his prayer. As silence prevailed, he gazed out over the field of wheat that surrounded us. Conquest. We arrived one afternoon at the ruins of an old castle of the Order of the Knights Templar. We sat down to rest, and while Petrus smoked his usual cigarette, I drank a bit of the wine left over from lunch. I studied the view that surrounded us, a few peasant houses, the tower of the castle, the undulating fields ready for sowing. To my right appeared a shepherd guiding his flock past the walls of the castle, bound for home. The sky was red, and the dust raised by the animals blurred the view, making it look like a dream or a magic vision. The shepherd waved to us, and we waved back. The sheep passed in front of us and continued down the road. Petrus got to his feet. It was an impressive scene, and I would have liked to have stayed, but Petrus said, "Let's go. Right away. We've got to hurry." "Why?" "Because I said so. Don't you think we have spent enough time on the road to Santiago?" But something told me that his haste had something to do with the magic scene of the shepherd and his sheep. 2 days later we were close to some mountains to the south. Their elevation was a relief to the monotony of the immense wheat fields. The area had some natural elevations, but it was well punctuated by the yellow markers that Father Jordi had mentioned. At that point, Petrus, without explanation, began to stray from the markers and to plunge more and more in a northerly direction. When I pointed this out to him, he answered brusquely, saying that he was the guide and he knew where he was leading me. After half an hour or so along the new path, I began to hear the sound of tumbling water. All around us were the sun-drenched fields, and I tried to imagine what the sound could be. As we continued, the sound grew louder, and there was no doubt that it was produced by a waterfall, but I could see neither mountains nor falls near us. Then, as we crested a small rise, we were confronted with one of nature's most extravagant works. A basin opened up in the plateau, deep enough to contain a five-story building, and a stream hurtled to its floor. The immense crater was bordered by luxuriant vegetation, completely different in appearance from the flora we had been passing until then, and it framed the falling water.
"Let's climb down here," Petrus said.
We began a descent that put me in mind of Jules Verne. It was as if we were descending to the center of the earth. The way was steep and difficult to navigate, and so as not to fall, we were forced to grasp at thorny branches and sharp rocks. When I reached the bottom, my arms and legs were lacerated.
"Isn't this beautiful?" said Petrus, taking no notice of my discomfort.
I agreed. It was an oasis in the desert. The plant life and the rainbow formed by the droplets of water made the basin as beautiful seen from below as from above.
"This is where nature really shows its power," he said.
"True," I nodded.
"And it gives us a chance to show our own strength."
"Let's climb the falls," said my guide, "through the water."
I looked again at the scene. Now I no longer saw it as an oasis, nor as one of nature's more sophisticated caprices. Instead, I was looking at a wall more than 50 feet high, over which the water fell with a deafening force. The small lagoon formed by the cataract was no deeper than a man's height, since the river ran to an opening that probably took it underground. On the wall, there were no protrusions that I could make use of in a climb, and the depth of the pool was not sufficient to break a fall. I was looking at an absolutely impossible task. I thought of an event from 5 years ago, during a ritual that had required, like this situation, an extremely dangerous climb. My master had given me a choice as to whether I wanted to continue or not. I was younger and fascinated by his powers and by the miracles of the tradition, so I decided to go on. I needed to demonstrate my courage and my bravery. After I'd climbed the mountain for nearly an hour, and as I was approaching the most difficult stretch, a wind of unexpected force arose, and to keep myself from falling I had had to cling with all my strength to the small ledge that supported me. I closed my eyes, expecting the worst, and dug my nails into the rock. A minute later I was surprised to find that someone had helped me to assume a safer and more comfortable position. I opened my eyes to see that my master was there at my side. He made some gestures in the air, and the wind suddenly ceased. With an absolutely mysterious agility, at times seeming to require an exercise in levitation, he descended the mountain, and told me to do likewise. I arrived at the base with my legs trembling and asked him angrily why he hadn't caused the wind to abate before it threatened me.
"Because it was I who ordered the wind to blow," he answered.
"So it would kill me?"
"No, in order to save you. It would have been impossible for you to climb this mountain. When I asked if you wanted to, I was not testing your courage. I was testing your wisdom."
"You made it into an order when I had not given one," said the master. "If you were able to levitate yourself, you would not have had a problem. But you wanted to be brave when it was enough to have been intelligent."
That day he told me about Magi who had become insane during the process of illumination, and who could no longer distinguish between their own powers and those of their disciples. During my lifetime I have known some great men in the tradition. I had gotten to know 3 great masters, including my own, who were able to dominate material objects in ways that went far beyond what anyone could imagine.
I had witnessed miracles, exact predictions of the future, and knowledge of past incarnations. My master had spoken of the Falklands War 2 months before Argentina had invaded the islands. He had described everything in detail, and had explained the reasons on an astral level for the conflict. But after that day I had begun to notice that there were magi who, in the master's words, had been crazed by the process of illumination. They were individuals who, in almost every way, were the equal of their masters, even with respect to their powers. I saw one of them make a seed germinate in 20 minutes of extreme concentration. But that man, and some others, had already led many disciples to madness and despair. Some of those disciples had had to be committed to mental hospitals, and there was at least one confirmed case of suicide. Those masters were on the blacklist of the tradition, but it was impossible to control them, and I know that many of them continue their work even today. All of this passed through my mind in a fraction of a second as I looked at the waterfall that seemed impossible to scale. I thought of the length of time that Petrus and I had traveled together, of the dog's attack that had left me unhurt, of Petrus's lack of control with the boy who had waited on us in the restaurant, and of Petrus's drinking bout at the wedding celebration. Those events were all I could remember. "Petrus, there's no way I'm going to climb that waterfall, and for a very simple reason. It's impossible." He didn't say a word. He sat down on the grass, and I did the same. We sat there in silence for 15 minutes. His silence disarmed me, and I took the initiative by beginning to speak. "Petrus, I don't want to climb because I'll fall. I know that I'm not going to die because when I saw the face of my death, I also saw the day it will happen. But I could fall and be crippled for the rest of my life."
"Paolo, Paolo," he looked at me and smiled. "You have completely changed. There is in your voice a bit of the love that consumes, and your eyes are shining."
"Are you going to say that I'm breaking a vow of obedience that I made before setting out on the road?"
"You're not breaking that vow. You're not afraid, and you're not lazy. Nor should you be thinking that I have given you a useless order. You don't want to climb the falls because you are thinking about the black magi."
This is the name given in the tradition to those masters who have lost their magical contact with their disciples, as just described. This expression is also used to describe masters who have interrupted their learning process after having established dominion only over earthly forces.
"You have not broken a vow just because you have used your decision-making ability. A pilgrim is never prevented from using that ability."
I looked again at the cataract, and again at Petrus. I was weighing my chances of success in making the climb, and they didn't weigh very much.
"Now, pay attention," he continued. "I am going to climb before you do, without using any gift, and I'm going to make it. If I succeed just by knowing where to place my feet, you will have to climb too. I am nullifying your freedom to make a decision. If you refuse after you have seen me make the climb, then you will be breaking your vow."
Petrus began to take off his sneakers. He was at least 10 years older than I, and if he succeeded in the climb, I would have no further excuse. I studied the waterfall and felt my stomach seize up. But he didn't move. Even though he had taken off his sneakers, he remained seated in the same place. He looked at the sky and said,
"A few kilometers from here, in 1502, the Virgin appeared to a shepherd. Today is the feast day commemorating that event, the feast of the Virgin of the Road, and I am going to offer my victory to her. I would advise you to do the same thing. Offer a victory to her. Don't offer the pain in your feet or the cuts on your hands from the rocks. Everybody in the world offers only pain as penance. There is nothing wrong with that, but I think she would be happier if, rather than just pain, people would also offer her their joys."
I was in no condition to speak. I still doubted whether Petrus could climb the wall. I thought the whole thing was a farce, that I was being drawn in by the way he spoke, and that he would then convince me to do something I really did not want to do. In the face of these doubts, I closed my eyes for a moment and prayed to the Virgin of the Road. I promised that if Petrus and I were able to climb the wall, I would one day return to this place. Everything you have learned up to now makes sense only if it is applied in real life. Don't forget that I described the road to Santiago to you as the road of the common person. I have said that 1,000 times. On the road to Santiago, and in life itself, wisdom has value only if it helps us to overcome some obstacle. A hammer would make no sense in the world if there were not nails to be driven. And even given the existence of nails, the hammer would be useless if it only thought, "I can drive those nails with 2 blows." The hammer has to act, to put itself into the hands of the carpenter, and to be used in its proper function. I remembered my master's words at Ichacha. Whoever has the sword must constantly put it to the test, so it doesn't rust in its scabbard. The waterfall is the place where you will put into practice everything you have learned so far, said my guide. There is one thing working in your favor. You know the day on which you are going to die, so that fear will not paralyze you when you have to decide quickly where to find a hold. But remember, you are going to have to work with the water, and use it to provide what you need. Remember that you have to dig a nail into your thumb if a bad thought takes over. And most important, that you have to find support for yourself in the love that consumes during every minute of the climb, because it is that love which directs and justifies your every step. Petrus fell silent. He took off his shirt and his shorts, and was completely naked. He went into the cold water of the lagoon, wet himself completely, and spread his arms to the sky. I could see that he was happy. He was enjoying the coldness of the water and the rainbows created by the mist that surrounded us. "One more thing," he said before going in under the falls. "This waterfall will teach you how to be a master. I'm going to make the climb, but there will be a veil of water between you and me. I will climb without your being able to see where I place my hands and feet. In the same way, a disciple such as you can never imitate his guide's steps. You have your own way of living your life, of dealing with problems, and of winning. Teaching is only demonstrating that it is possible. Learning is making it possible for yourself." He said nothing else as he disappeared through the veil of the cascade and began to climb. I could see only his outline, as if perceived through frosted glass. But I could see that he was climbing. Slowly and inexorably, he moved toward the top. The closer he got to the crest, the more fearful I became, because my time was coming. Finally, the most terrible moment arrived. The moment when he had to come up through the falling water without holding on to the sides. The force of the water would surely plunge him back to the ground. But Petrus's head emerged there at the top, and the falling water became his silver mantle. I saw him for just an instant, because, with a rapid motion, he threw his body upward and secured himself somehow on the top of the plateau, still immersed in the stream of water. Then I lost sight of him for some moments. Finally, Petrus appeared on the bank. He was bathed in moisture, brilliant in the sunlight, and laughing. "Let's go!" he yelled, waving his hands. "It's your turn!" It really was my turn. Either I did it or I forever renounced my sword. I took all of my clothes off and prayed again to the Virgin of the Road. Then I dived into the lagoon. It was freezing, and my body went rigid with its impact. But I then felt a pleasant sensation, a sensation of being really alive. Without thinking about it, I went straight to the waterfall. The weight of the water on my head brought me back to a sense of reality, the sense that weakens us at the moment when we most need to have faith in our powers. I could see that the falls had much more force than I had thought, and that if the water continued to fall directly onto the top of my head, it would defeat me, even if I kept both feet firmly planted on the bottom of the lagoon. I passed through the falls and stood between the water and the rock, in a space into which my body just fit, glued to the wall. From there, I could see that the task was easier than I had thought. The water did not beat down here, and what had appeared to me to be a wall with a polished surface was actually a wall with a great many cavities. I was dumbfounded to think that I might have renounced my sword out of fear of the smoothness of the wall, when it turned out to be the kind of rock that I had climbed dozens of times. I seemed to hear Petrus's voice saying, "Didn't I tell you? Once a problem is solved, its simplicity is amazing." I began to climb, with my face against the humid rock. In 10 minutes I was almost to the top. Only one hurdle remained, the final phase, the place where the water fell over the crest on its trajectory toward the lagoon. The victory I had won in making the climb would be worth nothing if I were not able to negotiate that last stretch that separated me from the open air. This was where the danger lay, and I had not been able to see how Petrus had succeeded. I prayed again to the Virgin of the Road, a virgin I had never heard of, but who was now the object of all my faith and all my hopes for success. I began tentatively to put first my hair and then my entire head up through the water that was rushing over and past me. The water covered me completely and blurred my vision. I began to feel its impact and held firmly to the rock. I bent my head to create an air pocket that would allow me to breathe. I trusted completely in my hands and feet. My hands had, after all, already held an ancient sword, and my feet had trod the road to Santiago. They were my friends, and they were helping me. But the noise of the water was deafening, and I began to have trouble breathing. I was determined to put my head through the flow, and for several seconds everything went black. I fought with all my strength to keep my hands and feet anchored to their holds, but the noise of the water seemed to take me to another place. It was a mysterious and distant place where nothing that was happening at that moment was at all important, and it was a place I could get to if I had the strength. In that place there would no longer be any need for the superhuman effort it took to keep my hands and feet holding to the rock. There would be only rest and peace. But my hands and feet did not obey this impulse to surrender. They had resisted a mortal temptation, and my head began to emerge from the stream as gradually as it had entered it. I was overcome by a profound love for my body. It was there, helping me in this crazy adventure of climbing through a waterfall in search of a sword. When my head came completely through the surface, I saw the bright sun above me and took a deep breath. This renewed my strength, and as I looked about I could see, just a few inches away, the plateau we had originally walked along, the end of the journey. I had an impulse to throw myself up and grab for something to hold, but I could see nothing to grab through the flowing water. The impulse was strong, but the moment of victory had not yet come, and I had to control myself. I was at the most difficult point in the ascent, with the water beating on my chest, and the pressure was threatening to throw me back to the place below that I had dared to leave in pursuit of my dream. It was no time to be thinking about masters or friends, and I could not look to the side to see if Petrus would be able to save me if I should slip. "He has probably made this climb a million times," I thought, "and he knows that here is where I most desperately need help." But he had abandoned me. Or maybe he hadn't abandoned me, but he was there somewhere behind me, and I couldn't turn to look for him without losing my balance. I had to do it all. I alone had to win my victory. I kept my feet and one hand holding to the rock, while the other hand let go and sought to become one with the water. I didn't want to exert any more effort because I was already using all of my strength.
My hand, knowing this, became a fish that gives itself up, but knows where it wants to go. I remembered films from my childhood in which I had seen salmon jumping over waterfalls because they had a goal and they simply had to achieve it. The arm rose slowly, using the force of the water to its advantage. It finally burst free, and it took on the task of finding a hold and deciding the fate of the rest of my body. Like a salmon in the film, the hand dived into the water atop the crest, searching for a place, a point, that would support me in the final leap. The rock had been polished by centuries of running water, but there must be a handhold. If Petrus had been able to find one, I could too. I began to feel great pain, because now I knew that I was only one step from success. This is the moment when one's strength begins to flag, and one loses confidence in oneself. On a few occasions in my life, I had lost at the last minute, swum across an ocean, and drowned in the surf of regret. But I was on the road to Santiago, and that old experience must not be allowed to repeat itself. I had to win. My free hand slid along the smooth stone, and the pressure was becoming stronger and stronger. I felt that my other limbs could not hold out, and that I was going to begin to cramp. The water was beating on my genitals, too, and the pain was unbearable. Then my free hand suddenly found a hold in the rock. It wasn't a large one, and it was off to the side of where I wanted to rise, but it would serve as a support for my other hand when its turn came. I marked its location mentally, and my free hand returned to its search for my salvation. A few inches from the first hold, I found another. There it was. There was the place that for centuries had served as a hold for the pilgrims bound for Santiago. I could see this, and I held on with all my strength. The other hand came free, was thrown back by the force of the water, but in an arc across the sky reached and found the handhold. With a quick movement, my entire body followed the path opened by my arms, and I threw myself upward. The biggest and final step had been taken. My whole body came up through the water, and a moment later the savage waterfall had become just a trickle of water, hardly moving. I crawled to the bank and gave in to exhaustion. The sun fell on my body, warming me, and I told myself again that I had won, that I was alive, as before, when I had stood below in the lagoon. Over the sound of the water I heard Petrus's approaching footsteps. I wanted to get up and show how happy I was, but my exhausted body refused. "Relax. Rest a little," he said. "Try to breathe slowly." I did so and fell into a deep, dreamless sleep. When I awoke, the sun had moved across the sky, and Petrus, already dressed, handed me my clothes and said we had to move on. "I'm very tired," I answered. "Don't worry. I am going to show you how to draw energy from everything around you." And Petrus taught me the ram breathing exercise. I did the exercise for 5 minutes and felt better. I arose, dressed, and grabbed my knapsack. "Come here," Petrus said. I went to the edge of the cliff. At my feet, the waterfall rushed by. "Looking at it from here, it looks a lot easier than it did from down there," I said. "Exactly. And if I had shown it to you from here before, you would have been misled. You would have made a poor analysis of your chances." I still felt weak, and I repeated the exercise. Shortly, the entire universe about me fell into harmony with me and came into my heart. I asked Petrus why he had not taught me the ram breathing before, since many times I had felt lazy and tired on the road to Santiago. "Because you never looked like you felt that way," he said, laughing. Then he asked me if I still had any of the delicious butter cookies I had bought in Astorga. The ram breathing exercise. Expel all the air from your lungs, emptying them as much as you can. Then,
Inhale slowly as you raise your arms as high as possible. As you inhale, concentrate on allowing love, peace, and harmony with the universe to enter into your body. Hold the air you have taken in and keep your arms raised for as long as you can, enjoying the harmony between your inner sensations and the outer world. When you reach your limit, exhale all of the air rapidly as you say the word Ram. Repeat this process for 5 minutes each time you do the exercise.
Madness. For 3 days we had been making a kind of forced march. Petrus would wake me before daybreak, and we would not end our day's hike before 9 in the evening. The only rest stops granted were for quick meals, since my guide had abolished our siesta. He gave the impression that he was keeping to some mysterious schedule that he hadn't shared with me. What's more, his behavior had changed completely. At first I thought it had something to do with my hesitation at the waterfall, but later I could see that it was not that. He was irritable with everyone, and he looked at his watch frequently during the day. I reminded him that it was he who had told me that we ourselves create the pace of time.
"You're becoming wiser every day," he answered. "Let's see if you can put all this wisdom into play when it is needed."
On one afternoon I was so tired from the pace of our hiking that I simply could not get up. Petrus told me to take my shirt off and settle my spine along the trunk of a nearby tree. I held that position for several minutes and felt much better. He began to explain to me that vegetation, and especially mature trees, are able to transmit harmony when one rests one's nerve centers against a tree trunk. For hours he discoursed on the physical, energetic, and spiritual properties of plants. Since I had already read all of this somewhere, I didn't worry about taking notes, but Petrus's discourse helped to diminish my feeling that he was irritated with me. Afterward, I treated his silence with greater respect, and he, perhaps guessing correctly at my apprehension, tried to be friendlier whenever his constant bad mood allowed him to do so. We arrived one morning at an immense bridge, totally out of proportion to the modest stream that coursed below it. It was early on a Sunday morning, and, since the bars and taverns nearby were all closed, we sat down there to eat our breakfast. "People and nature are equally capricious," I said, trying to start a conversation. "We build beautiful bridges, and then Mother Nature changes the course of the rivers they cross."
"It's the drought," he said. "Finish your sandwich, because we have to move along."
I decided to ask him why we were in such a hurry.
"We have been on the road to Santiago for a long time. I have already told you that I left a lot of things unattended in Italy, and I have got to get back."
I wasn't convinced. What he was saying might well be true, but it wasn't the only issue. When I started to question what he had said, he changed the subject.
"What do you know about this bridge?"
"Nothing," I answered. "But even with the drought, it's too big. I think the river must have changed its course."
"As far as that goes, I have no idea," he said. "But it is known along the road to Santiago as the Honorable Passage. These fields around us were the site of some bloody battles between the Suevians and the Visigoths, and later between Alphonse III's soldiers and the Moors. Maybe the bridge is oversized to allow all that blood to run past without flooding the city."
He was making an attempt at macabre humor. I didn't laugh, and he was put off for a moment, but then he continued,
"However, it wasn't the Visigoth hordes or the triumphant cries of Alphonse III that gave this bridge its name. It was another story of love and death. During the first centuries of the road to Santiago, pilgrims, priests, nobles, and even kings came from all over Europe to pay homage to the saint. Because of this, there was also an influx of assailants and robbers. History has recorded innumerable cases of robbery, of entire caravans of pilgrims, and of horrible crimes committed against lone travelers."
Just like today, I thought.
"Because of the crimes,
some of the nobility decided to provide protection for the pilgrims, and each of the nobles involved took responsibility for protecting one segment of the road. But just as rivers change their course, people's ideals are subject to alteration. In addition to frightening the malefactors, the knights began to compete with each other to determine who was the strongest and the most courageous on the road. It wasn't long before they began to do battle with each other, and the bandits returned to the road with impunity. This developed over a long period of time until, in 1434, a noble from the city of León fell in love with a woman. The man was Don Suero de Quiñones. He was powerful and rich, and he did everything in his power to win this lady's hand in marriage. But this woman, history has forgotten her name, did not even want to know about his grand passion, and rejected his request. I was dying of curiosity to know what an unrequited love had to do with battles among the knights. Petrus saw that I was interested and said that he would relate the rest of the story only if I finished my sandwich and we began to move along. "You're just like my mother when I was a child," I said. But I gulped down the last morsel of bread, picked up my knapsack, and we began to make our way through the sleepy city. Petrus continued, "Our gentleman, whose pride had been offended, resolved to do what all men do when they feel themselves to have been rejected. He began a private war. He promised himself that he was going to perform such an important feat that the woman would never forget his name. For months he sought a noble idea that would consecrate his spurned love. And then he heard of the crimes and the battles along the road to Santiago. That gave him an idea. He called together 10 of his friends, and they set themselves up in the small city we are passing through right now. He spread the word by means of the pilgrims that he was prepared to remain there for 30 days and break 30 lances in order to prove that he was the strongest and boldest of all the knights of the road. He established himself with his banners, his standards, his pages, and his servants, and waited for challengers. I could imagine what a picnic that must have been. Roast boar, endless supplies of wine, music, stories, and battles. A lively picture came to my mind as Petrus related the rest of the story. The bouts began on the 10th of July with the arrival of the first challengers. Quiñones and his companions fought during the day and held huge feasts every night. The contests were always held on the bridge so that no one could flee. During one period so many challengers came that fires were built along the entire length of the bridge so that the bouts could go on until dawn. All of the vanquished knights were required to swear that they would never again do battle with the others, and that from then on their only mission would be to protect the pilgrims going to Compostela. On the 9th of August the combat ended, and Don Suero de Quiñones was recognized as the bravest and most valiant of all the knights of the road to Santiago. From that day forward, no one dared to issue challenges of bravery, and the nobles returned to their battle against the only enemy in common, the bandits who assaulted the pilgrims. This epic was later to give rise to the military order of Santiago of the Sword. We had crossed the small city. I wanted to go back and take another look at the honorable passage, the bridge on which all of that had taken place, but Petrus said that we had to move on. "And what happened to Don Quiñones?" I asked. "He went to Santiago de Compostela and placed a golden necklace at Santiago's shrine. Even today it adorns the bust of Santiago the Lesser." I was asking whether he wound up marrying the lady.
"Oh, I don't know," Petrus answered. "In those days history was written only by men. With such a battlefield close at hand, who was going to be interested in a love story?"
After telling me the story of Don Suero de Quiñones, my guide went back to his now habitual silence, and we went along for 2 more days without a word. We hardly stopped to rest. On the 3rd day, though, Petrus began to walk more slowly than usual.
He said that he was a bit tired from the efforts of the week, and that he was too old to continue at that pace. Again, I was sure that he was not telling the truth. His face, rather than showing fatigue, revealed an intense preoccupation, as if something very important was about to occur. We arrived that afternoon in Fontsébadon, a large village that was completely in ruins. The houses, built of stone, had slate roofs that had been destroyed by time and the rotting of the wood that supported them. One side of the village gave onto a precipice, and in front of us, behind a mountain peak, was one of the most important landmarks of the road to Santiago, the Iron Cross. This time it was I who was impatient. I wanted to get to that strange monument, comprised of an immense wooden base, almost 30 feet tall, topped by the Iron Cross. The cross had been left there during the epoch of Caesar's invasion, in homage to Mercury. Observing the pagan tradition, the pilgrims along the Jacobean route were accustomed to leaving stones brought from elsewhere at the base of the cross. I took advantage of the abundance of stones in the abandoned village and picked up a piece of slate. It was only when I had resolved to move along more quickly that I saw that Petrus was walking more slowly. He examined the ruined houses and the fallen tree trunks, and finally decided to sit down in the middle of one of the plazas where there was a wooden cross. "Let's rest a bit," he said. It was early afternoon, so even if we stayed there for an hour, there would still be time to reach the Iron Cross before nightfall. I sat down beside him and gazed at the empty surroundings. Just as rivers change their course, humans also change where they live. The houses were solid and must have lasted for a long time before falling into ruin. It was a pretty place, with mountains in the distance and a valley in front of us. I asked myself what could have happened to cause the people to leave such a place. "Do you think that Don Suero de Quiñones was crazy?" Petrus asked. I did not even remember who Don Suero was, and he had to remind me about the honorable passage. "I don't think he was crazy," I answered. But I wasn't sure about my answer. "Well, he was, just as Alfonso, the monk that you met, was. Just as I am, as you can see from the plans that I make. Or you, seeking your sword. Every one of us has the flame of madness burning inside, and it is fed by agape. Crazy doesn't mean you want to conquer America, or talk to the birds like St. Francis of Assisi. Even a vegetable vendor on the street corner can show this flame of madness if he likes what he is doing. Agape is grander than our ordinary human concepts, and everyone thirsts for it." Petrus told me that I knew how to invoke agape by means of the blue sphere exercise, but in order for agape to flourish, I must not be afraid to change my life. If I liked what I was doing, very well. But if I did not, there was always the time for a change. If I allowed change to occur, I would be transforming myself into a fertile field and allowing the creative imagination to sow its seeds in me. Everything I have taught you, including agape, makes sense only if you're satisfied with yourself. If you're not, then the exercises you have learned are inevitably going to make you seek change. And if you do not want all of those exercises to work against you, you have to allow change to happen. This is the most difficult moment in a person's life, when the person witnesses the good fight and is unable to change and join the battle. When this happens, knowledge turns against the person who holds it. I looked at the deserted city of Fontsébadon. Maybe all of those people, collectively, had felt the need for a change. I asked whether Petrus had chosen this place purposely, in order to say all of this to me. "I don't know what happened here," he answered. "Often people have to accept the changes that destiny forces upon them, but that's not what I'm talking about. I am speaking of an act of will.
a concrete desire to do battle against everything that is unsatisfying in one's everyday life. On the road of our lives, we always run into problems that are hard to solve, like, for example, passing through a waterfall without letting it make us fall. So you have to allow the creative imagination to do its work. In your case, the waterfall was a life-and-death situation, and there wasn't time to consider many options. Agape showed you the only way. But there are problems in our lives that require us to choose between one way and another. Everyday problems, like a business decision, the breakup of a relationship, a social obligation. Each of these small decisions we have to make throughout our lives might represent a choice between life and death. When you leave the house in the morning on your way to work, you might choose one means of transportation that would drop you off safe and sound, or another that is going to crash and kill its passengers. This is a radical example of how a simple decision may affect us for the rest of our lives. I began to think about myself as Petrus spoke. I had chosen to walk the road to Santiago in search of my sword. It was the sword that was most important to me now, and I needed somehow to find it. I had to make the right decision. "The only way to make the right decision is to know what the wrong decision is," he said after I had mentioned my concern. "You have to examine the other path, without fear and without being morbid, and then decide." It was then that Petrus taught me the shadows exercise. "Your problem is your sword," he said after he had explained the exercise. I agreed. The shadows exercise. Relax completely. For 5 minutes, study the shadows of all the objects and people around you. Try to identify exactly which part of the object or person is casting a shadow. For the next 5 minutes, continue to do this, but at the same time focus on the problem you are trying to solve. Look for all of the possible wrong solutions to the problem. Finally, spend 5 more minutes studying the shadows and thinking about what correct solutions remain. Eliminate them, one by one, until only the single correct solution is left. So do the exercise now. I'm going to take a walk. When I come back, I know that you will have the right solution. I remembered how much of a hurry Petrus had been in during the past few days. Yet now we were having a prolonged conversation in this abandoned city. It seemed to me that he was trying to gain some time so that he, too, could make a decision regarding something. This made me excited, and I began to do the exercise. I did a bit of ram breathing to put me in harmony with my surroundings. Then I noted on my watch when 15 minutes would have passed, and I began to look at the shadows all around me. Shadows of ruined houses, stones, wood, and the cross behind me. As I studied the shadows, I saw that it was difficult to know exactly what part was casting any given shadow. I had never noticed this before. Some house beams that were straight were transformed into shadows with sharp angles, and an irregular stone cast a shadow with a smoothly rounded form. I did this for 10 minutes. The exercise was so fascinating that it was not difficult to concentrate on it. Then I began to think of the wrong solutions to the problem of finding my sword. Many ideas came to mind. I thought about taking a bus to Santiago, and then I thought about phoning my wife and using some sort of emotional trickery to find out where she had placed it. When Petrus returned, I was smiling. "So?" he asked. "I found out how Agatha Christie wrote her mystery novels," I joked. "She transformed the hunch that was most wrong into the one that was correct. She must have known about the exercise of the shadows." Petrus asked where my sword was. "First, I'm going to tell you the most erroneous guess that I came up with as I looked at the shadows. That the sword is somewhere other
than on the road to Santiago.
You are a genius. You figured out that we have been walking all this way in order to find your sword. I thought they had told you that already in Brazil.
It's being kept in a safe place that my wife could not enter, I continued. I deduced that it's in an absolutely open place, but that it has been assimilated so well into its surroundings that it can't be seen.
This time, Petrus didn't smile.
I went on. And since the most absurd thing would be that it is in a place where there are lots of people, it has to be in some locale that is practically deserted. And most important, and so that the few people who see it don't notice the difference between it and a typical Spanish sword, it must be in a place where no one knows how to distinguish between styles of swords.
"Do you think it is here?" he asked.
"No, it's not here. The thing that would be most wrong would be to do this exercise at the place where my sword is. I discarded that hunch right away. It must be in a city that is similar to this one, but it cannot be in an abandoned city, because a sword in an abandoned city would attract a lot of attention from pilgrims and passers-by. It would wind up as a decoration on the wall of a bar."
"Very good," he said, and I could see that he was proud of me, or of the exercise he had taught me.
"There's another thing," I said.
"What's that?"
"The place that would be most wrong for the sword of Amagus to be left is a profane place. It has to be in a sacred place, like a church, for example, where no one would dare to steal it. So, in a church, in a small city near Santiago, visible to everyone but embedded in its surroundings, that's where my sword is. Starting now, I'm going to visit every church on the road."
"You don't have to," he said.
"When the moment comes, you will know it."
I had been right.
"Listen, Petrus, why did we hurry for such a long while, when now we're spending so much time in this abandoned city?"
"What would be the answer that is most wrong?"
I glanced at the shadows. He was right. We were there for some reason. The sun was hidden behind the mountain, but nightfall was still some hours away. I was thinking that the sun was probably shining just then on the Iron Cross. The cross was only a few hundred yards distant, and I really wanted to see it. I also wanted to know why we were waiting around. We had moved along so rapidly for the entire week, and now it seemed to me that the only reason for that must have been that we had to be at this place, on this day, and at this time. I tried to make conversation to pass the time, but I could see that Petrus was tense and preoccupied. I had already seen Petrus in a bad mood many times, but I could not remember having seen him so tense. And then I remembered that I had seen him like this once. It was at breakfast one morning in a small town whose name I could not remember, just before we had run into... I looked to my left. There he was, the dog, the ferocious dog that had thrown me to the ground, the coward of a dog that had immediately fled afterward. Petrus had promised to help me if we ran into him again, and I turned to my guide, but he had disappeared. I kept my gaze fixed on the dog's eyes while I frantically tried to think of a way to deal with the situation. Neither of us moved, and I was reminded for a moment of the duel scenes in the ghost towns of Western movies. In those films, no one would ever have dreamed of pitting a man against a dog. It just wouldn't have worked. Yet here I was, confronted with a reality that fiction would have considered too far out. And there was Legion, so named because he was so many. Nearby stood a deserted house. If I were to bolt suddenly, I could climb to its roof, and Legion could not follow. It seemed absurd that I felt trapped by the physical presence of a dog and all that his presence implied. As I kept my eyes on him, I immediately rejected the possibility of taking flight. Many times along the road I had feared this moment, and now here it was. Before I could find my sword, I had to meet with the enemy and either vanquish him or be defeated by him. I had no choice but to go up against him. If I fled now, I would be falling into a trap.
It might be that the dog would not appear again, but that I would travel the road to Santiago de Compostela gripped by fear and apprehension. Ever afterward I would dream about the dog, fearing his reappearance at any minute and living with dread for the rest of my life. As I thought about this, the dog started toward me. I stopped thinking immediately and concentrated only in the battle that was about to begin. Petrus had left, and I was alone. I was frightened. And as I experienced that fear, the dog began to move closer, making a low growling sound. The growl was much more threatening than a loud bark would have been, and I became even more terrified. Seeing the weakness in my eyes, the dog leapt on me. It was as if a boulder had been thrown at my chest. I fell to the ground, and he began to bite at me. I remembered vaguely that I already knew about my death, and that it was not to be like this. But even so, my fear grew, and I was unable to control it. I began to fight just to protect my face and throat. An intense pain in my leg caused me to curl up, and I could see that some flesh had been torn away. I took my hands from my head and throat, reaching toward the wound. The dog, seeing this, began an assault on my face. At that moment, one of my hands felt a rock at my side. I grasped it and began to beat on the dog with all my strength. He backed off a bit, more surprised than hurt, and I was able to stand. The dog continued to retreat, and the bloody stone gave me courage. I was paying too much respect to the strength of my enemy, and this was a trap. He could not be any stronger than I. He might be more agile, but he could not be stronger, because I weighed more and was taller than he. My fear had lessened, but I wasn't in control of myself yet, and with the rock in my hand I began to shout at the dog. He withdrew a little further, and then suddenly stopped. It seemed as if he were reading my mind. In my desperation I was beginning to feel strong, and I began to think that it was ridiculous to be fighting a dog. A sense of power suddenly came to me, and a hot wind began to blow across the deserted city. Then I began to be tired of the whole thing. When all was said and done, I had only to batter him once on the head with the stone, and I would have won. I wanted it to be over immediately so that I could dress my wound and put an end to this absurd business of swords and the strange road to Santiago. But this was another trap. The dog hurled himself at me and again pushed me to the ground. This time he evaded the rock easily, biting my hand and causing me to let it go. I began to punch him with my hands, but I was not causing any serious damage. The only thing my blows accomplished was to keep him from biting me even more. His sharp claws began to tear at my clothing and my arms, and I saw that it was only a matter of time before he took charge completely. All of a sudden I heard a voice from within me. The voice said that if the dog established dominion over me, the fight would be over and I would be saved, defeated, but alive. My leg was aching and my entire body stung from its lacerations. The voice insisted that I give up, and I recognized whose voice it was. It was Astrain, my messenger, speaking to me. The dog stopped for a moment, as if he had heard the same voice, and once again I felt like leaving the whole thing behind. Astrain had told me in our conversations that many people fail to find the sword in their lives. And what difference did it make? What I wanted to do was go home, be with my wife, have my children, and work at what I liked. Enough of these absurdities, fighting with dogs and climbing waterfalls. This was the second time that this thought had come to me, but the desire to give up was even stronger now, and I was certain that I would surrender. A sound from the streets of the abandoned city caught the animal's attention. I looked in the direction of the sound and saw a shepherd returning from the fields with his flock. I remembered that I had seen this scene before, in the ruins of an old castle. When the dog spotted the sheep, he jumped away from me and made ready to attack them. This was my salvation. The shepherd started to yell, and the sheep scattered. Before the dog got completely away, I decided to engage him for another moment or two, just to provide enough time for the animals to flee. I grabbed one of the dog's legs. I had the absurd hope that the shepherd might come to my assistance, and for a moment my hopes about the sword and the power of Ram returned. The dog tried to pull away from me. I was no longer the enemy. I was a hindrance. What he wanted now was there in front of him, the sheep. But I continued to grasp the animal's leg, awaiting a shepherd who would not come, and suddenly hoping that the sheep would not take flight. This is what saved my soul. An immense feeling of strength infused me. It was no longer the illusion of power which causes one to become weary of the battle and to want to give in. Astrain whispered to me again, but this time it was something different. He said that I should always confront the world with the same weapons that were used.